is Forces Radio.
This is BFBS. Original Forces programs. Cassidy D. Little, coming home.
Something's very wrong in the situation that you're in. Something is very bad is in your surrounding. So everybody who had a metal detector got their metal detectors out and started sweeping through to find out, see if they could find anything. And they couldn't find anything. There was nothing coming up on the metal detectors. Then a friend of mine who had won a military cross in Herrick 9, I believe, stepped on an IED. I originally was a ballet dancer, or at least a dancer. I wasn't particularly good at ballet, but I was definitely a dancer. But I was doing a tap dancing routine, and I twisted too hard and too quickly, and my foot didn't rotate fast enough with me. And as a result, I ripped my cartilage and lost my scholarship in the university that I was studying at in the United States of America. A fact I neglected to mention to the Royal Marines recruiting office. I went back to Canada, and I had a couple of years of being a bit of a misfit. I knew that I enjoyed the bar industry, and I knew I enjoyed kind of being the light of a party, the life of the party. So bartending was natural for me to go into, because you just end up living this kind of vampire lifestyle of, you know, feeding people what they want and then having a great party at the same time. So I did that for a couple of years and had a really good time. I invented shooters. It was a lot of fun. My stepfather is British. He's a businessman here in this country. He came down to the bar once and said that he had some tickets for a comedy show. A guy named George Carlin was doing the stand-up routine. And George Carlin, unfortunately, is dead now, but he used to do some very, very, very strange jokes.
Well, we like war. We like war. We're a warlike people. People.
So we went to see him, and we came away from that. And we were at the bar I was working at, sitting there having a pint of lager. And my stepfather said, you know, what'd you think of that? I said, well, it was pretty funny. And he said, what, just pretty funny? He said, well, yeah, I reckon I could do better than that. I mean, George Carlin was funny, but it wasn't that funny. I reckon I could be funnier with a bit of work. He said, well, put your money where your mouth is. I said, all right, but it's not exactly a stand-up comedy scene in St. John's, Newfoundland. And he said, come to England. I'll give you a job in one of the warehouses I own, and you can stay with me until you get your feet, you know, get on your feet. And, you know, as long as you're doing stand-up comedy, you know, you can crash a mine. Anyway, we're sitting around in a bar called the Lord Burley. We're talking about my ability to finish things. My stepsister and her now husband were at the table too. And they, you know, she said, you're not the kind of person that, you know, finishes things that you start. My girlfriend at the time turned to me and said, yeah, they've got a great point. Now, the next part of the story is very blue. But what I will say is that she and I made a bet that involved me quitting smoking. And a month later, I quit smoking. And then she and I made another bet about me getting in the shape, because she said she'd be more attracted to me if I was more stacked. And I said, okay, well, I'll give that a try. And so we made another wager in order to motivate me to do this. Now, at first I thought, okay, joining the army is the best way to do that, because, you know, you got to do pull-ups and sit-ups and push-ups and all that kind of stuff. So I'll just go to join the army. And then when they ask me to actually join, I'll say, no, thank you. It's not for me. I'll be in good shape. I'll win the bet. I'll still do stand-up comedy. Problem solved. A friend of mine, he was in the RAF. I was working with him at Air Blast at that warehouse, a guy named Paul. Paul turned to me and said, you know, if you do that, you're still perpetuating the cycle. You're still quitting something that you've started. And I said, yeah. He said, why not pick the hardest one? Everybody respects a failure. Nobody respects a quitter. At least a failure, you gave it your best. So if you pick the hardest one and you're never going to achieve it, you're essentially setting yourself up to fail. Everybody would be happy for you for trying. You won't have to actually join the military. You'll be super stacked. You'll win the bet and jobs are good. I said, okay, who's the hardest organization to join? He said, the Royal Marine Commandos, hands down. Longest and hardest basic training in the world. And on top of that, their current advertising slogan is 99.99% need not apply. So I said, okay. He said, seriously, they're looking for Rottweilers. You're a Labrador Retriever. job's good.
Off you go, good lad, get away.
So the next day, I walked in the recruiting office and signed up for the Royal Marine Commandos. I think the first thing, everybody, including myself, had no expectation of me succeeding. I walk in to the recruiting office. They put me through an intelligence test, which everybody was a little bit surprised I passed. Then they put me into a knowledge test, which I'd studied for, so I passed the knowledge test. And once you've passed your medical, then you're stacked up to go onto your potential Royal Marines course, which is the infamous 3 days of hell that they used to use for an advertising slogan. You know, where's your breaking point? Is it here? Is it here? So all along these lines, I was consistently asked, are you sure this is something you want to do? Are you sure that it's the core that you want to go into? I'd made a deal with myself that this wasn't a situation where I was going to quit. They would have to ask me to go home. I will never say the words, I want to go home. I will never say that. No matter what happens, I'll never say that. You know, they could hang me upside down and dip me into a vat of ants, and I'll still say, this is really bad and I really don't like it, please stop. But if they say, would you like to go home, I'll say no. If they say go home, then I'll say okay. But if they say, would you like to go home, I'll never give them the opportunity to send me home. I'll never give in, is the point. You know, the shock of capture for that first week was insane. You're sleeping in a room full of 50 blokes, and they literally teach you from the very basics, from the very, very, very basics, how to iron something, how to wash yourself, how to make a bed, how to eat with a knife and fork. They teach you this, how to brush your teeth. And the point is that even before you get to how to load and unload and make safe, they teach you these basics, because if you're ever caught not doing the basics, then you can stand by. Then you're in trouble. Right? If a corporal walked up to you and looked at your teeth and they were honking and your breath was stinking, and he said, have you brushed your teeth this morning? There is no excuse for you to say no. None. You'll be in trouble. And that's just very basic. Because if you can't be trusted to manage or maintain your own teeth, then how can you be expected to manage a weapon system? There was everybody in there, right? It was started with 50 or 54 of us. There's tons of us. They're from everywhere, all walks of life, everywhere from me from Canada, St. Vincent, guys from Scotland, guys from Wales, guys from England. There are posh guys, not so posh guys, smart guys, absolute idiots. You know, there are bodybuilders, and we all got to know each other. You know, those first nights, we all kind of swore that we'd have each other's back and we'd all get through it and all that kind of stuff. You're not allowed to quit for the first 4 weeks. Their idea is that they've spent so much money up until now getting you to that point, they want you to have a good go at it before they send you home. So no, even if you wanted to go home on the first night because you missed mom or you forgot your favorite stuffed animal, you couldn't, because you're not allowed to leave until a month from the first one. So you know you're in it for a month. And I think that was daunting for a lot of people. So obviously, we all made the first month. I moved around a lot when I was a kid. I employed the tactic of, try and become the class clown. Try and make some jokes. Try not to get in too much trouble. Subtlety gets you nowhere, and not being noticed doesn't give you an upper hand. Being noticed gives you an upper hand. So I tried to employ that kind of class clown, you can't break me because I'm too happy kind of person. They'll still throw you in the water if you're acting out. They'll still, you'll still do press-ups until your eyes bleed if you're not pulling your weight. They're still going to shake you at, oh, stupid o'clock to yell at you because you don't have your boots on, because that's what their job is. Our final graduation group had 13 of the original 54 guys. I mean, we had a couple other guys that were back trooped in, so I think our graduation class was like 26 or something like that. But of the original photograph that they took, 13 guys were left. And don't get me wrong, there are some parts of Limpston Commando Training Center that are a lot of fun. Okay, a lot of fun. Let's just remember what you're training for, what your goal is here. Okay, I went into the Royal Marine Commandos thinking I was going to come out Jason Bourne, right? So I was expecting, ninja training and, I don't know what I was expecting. I think there's too much Hollywood in my mind. But some of the stuff they taught us was awesome. Fast roping is awesome. There's no way, no other way to say it. When you're in a helicopter and it's hovering over top of the deck of a ship and it's moving and the helicopter's moving and you're not attached to a safety line and you've got gloves on and there's just this big rope and you're weighed down with kit and you know that there's 30 feet between you and, I'd like to say the soft deck, but it's not. It's a hard, hard, fake concrete deck. And you're coming out in the blustering wind and you know that somewhere on there you may have to clamp off because the ship goes one way and the helicopter that goes the other way, or you're going into the water and you will be dead. So it's exhilarating. You know, dunker drills are fun. You know, attacks, properly coordinated attacks, stalking drills where you're learning about camouflage and you're learning about how to do proper face paint so that you don't look like a clown, but rather you're trying to emulate the bushes and the surrounding that you're in. You know, being in the field is essentially like camping, except it's ruined because you have to do sentry, which means somebody's going to wake you up every couple hours to get out of your dry, warm pit and put on some wet clothes and stand staring, looking for any sign of an enemy, in the pitch black. That ruins the camping trip. But if it weren't for sentry, it would essentially be a boys' camping trip of running around playing soldiers and getting your head down in a nice, warm, cozy sleeping bag at night. So there are some good memories that come out of that. But on the other hand, there are some vile, vile, vile feelings. Like, I remember on Final X, which is one of the it's the last exercise you do. It's the culmination of all the commando training that you've done. I remember being on sentry on a moor in Dartmoor. I was looking out over Plymouth. And I was cold, and I'd been up for a long time, and I was hungry because we were doing hard routine that night, so whatever I was eating, it was cold, and, I was staring out over these lights, and it wasn't like yucking it down. It was that middle ground where it was just miserable and drizzly, so the water feels like it's getting into your bones. And it's coming sideways, too. It's not straight down, because it's Dartmoor. Rain never comes straight down on Dartmoor. It's not allowed to. It kind of either comes sideways or up from the grass. It's horrible. And I'm staring out at Plymouth, and it's nighttime, and I can see all the twinkling lights, and I can think, and all I could think was, somebody's out there in a pub right now, having a really cold beer, trying to chat somebody up, and I'm up here just hating my life. Why am I doing this? And it's moments like that that you have to press through. That's a wall. That's a massive wall when that thought comes into your mind, because you got to sweep that aside and say, oh man, okay, I've only got, 53 more minutes of this sentry before I have to go and shake the next guy and then get, an hour's head down before I do a patrol. So, yeah. It was tough, but it should be tough. I've passed out of basic training, and I accidentally got a diamond. The diamond is kind of a sign of possible leader potential, which is ridiculous because I feel that I barely scraped my way through the 32 weeks at Limston. And, anyway, I took it. And because of that, I had preference of where I wanted to go. They said, where do you want to go? And I thought, let's get straight into Afghanistan. Let's go there quick. This is why I joined, right? Go to war, so let's go to war. So I volunteered immediately, straight out of basic training, to go to Afghanistan. And I was loaded over to Lima Company, 4-2 Commando Royal Marines, for Herrick 5.
Forces Radio. The FBS. Cassidy Little, coming home.
Herrick 5 was very, very difficult. It was the winter season. Afghanistan's a whole lot colder than you think it is in the wintertime. And rain in the desert is a very, very funny thing. Watching raindrops hit dusty sand as it makes their own little kind of drop pattern, it's interesting. And we did a lot of observation posts, which, required us to climb up mountains. And it was neat. It was hard. Some of it was fun. Firefights are fun until somebody gets hurt. But, where's war? And I felt like a bootneck. You know, I felt the men that were around me helped me feel like a bootneck because we all behaved like bootnecks. And I liked that. Afghanistan is a little bit like an awesome action holiday, except ruined by lack of sleep. You know, lack of sleep is just horrendous. It's just such a difficult thing. You know, if you're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, it's very easy to patrol. It's very fun to be on your game and be wide awake and ready for anything, and, you know. But you know what? The enemy don't operate in regular hours. Well, sometimes they don't operate in regular hours. And you know what? If you want to operate under their radar, then you have to operate outside of regular hours. And so you need to get it into your head that you know, working 9 to 5 isn't what you're going to be doing. I actually thought, other than the fact that the whole bloody country seems to be mined, it's a beautiful country. It was a beautiful country. It is a beautiful country. In Kajaki, if it weren't for all those goddamn mines, you could probably put a resort there, especially up by the dam, you know, up by that blue water and that crisp sand. It's amazing. It's gorgeous. But there's more mines there than there is anywhere else in the world.
But it was early days. Then I had my R&R. And I came out of Sangin, went home, and home was horrible. I mean, it was lovely to see my girlfriend, who's now my wife. It was lovely to see her. It was lovely, but I woke up every morning searching the news.
This is the 100th time the people of Wooden Bassett have
hoping
gathered here this
that
year.
There was no casualties in Afghanistan while I was away. And I wasn't a medic at that time. I was just a gunner. Like, I was just a mini-me gunner. But I was so concerned about the guys that were out there that, you know, my R&R felt plagued by guilt, which, of course, compounded the guilt because instead of being in the moment with my girlfriend, I was feeling guilty, or instead of being in the moment. So I was feeling guilty that I wasn't in the moment with my girlfriend because I was feeling guilty about not going through hardship with the guys. It seems so unfair that I would spend 2 weeks just drinking at the pub instead of sitting in the dust up to my neck. It wasn't until after Herrick 5 that I noticed that, like, I'd find myself, you know, I'd wake up bolt upright looking for my rifle and stuff like that. But I had no reason to develop those types of acute awareness, those kinds of battle mentality, because I hadn't been in contact yet. So she was fine. She was just a little bit like, everything okay? You know, you good? Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I'm just, you know, I'm just keeping an eye on the news. You know, I don't. And she's not an idiot. She's smart. She's so smart. So she can work through it so well. She understood well. And she's such an empathetic human being. I'm very, a very, very lucky man. And I know my daughter is going to be, you know, twice the person that she and I are. So I'm lucky on all fronts. I asked to go to 4-2 Commando Royal Marines because I was under the impression they were going back to Afghanistan the quickest. And so I became J Company medic, the Jokers, the Juliet. I deployed with them. I spent 2 months in CP Omar with about 16 other guys as their medic. And we were on something called, well, it doesn't matter what it was called. We were on a strike op. We were out doing the job and we'd occupied an area and we'd been in a defensive shoot for a while, and for about a week. And as I understand it, it was time to push out and get out and find the guys who kept shooting at us. So we went out. A friend of mine, we just stopped to have lunch at a prayer garden. It was incredibly green. It was the greenest thing I think I've ever seen in Afghanistan. In my memory, it's almost neon green. It's almost like a neon sign from downtown Las Vegas, but it can't be. It can't have been that bright, but with the sun, the hot desert sun shining down on it, and just all that green reflecting back, and it was like a golf course. It was cut so short and so perfectly done, and I, you know, you couldn't help but notice that the gentleman who had done this, you know, this was his prayer garden. This is where he prayed, and he must have a tremendous amount of love and respect for the God that he followed. So we did our best not to step on that green area. We were kind of posted up on all four corners of that and just kind of eating that pate that you get in the rations with some fruit biscuits. Just chowing that down, a little bit of water. And then we decided we were going to go to the compound across the field, and it was not uncommon. I mean, one of the big things in Afghanistan is to seek local knowledge, right? You need to seek the locals' knowledge. You need to, you know, so what we would do is we would get locals to guide us the safe route. Because if we just did one big, long, extended line, we may as well have been walking minesweepers. So we were all in a kind of Afghan snake following this one young man across the field. This is where my memory starts to get a little fuzzy. I remember there being a kind of an archway and a black, almost cast iron gate with a chain on it at the end of it. And people started yelling and saying that they'd found a room with, like, spark plugs in it and, you know, bits and pieces in it and machinery in it. And I thought, well, this can't be unusual for a farming community to have things like that. If they have a tractor, they must have to change the spark plugs in the tractor or whatever the case may be. I don't know anything about cars, but that's kind of what my mind was going. And that's the time that our guide bolted. He got out of the, you know, he just, boom, he was gone. Now that's a big combat indicator. That right there is pretty much one big massive flare going straight up in the sky saying something's very wrong in the situation that you're in. Something is very bad is in your surrounding. You're now just plain luck now. So everybody who had a metal detector got their metal detectors out and started sweeping through to find out, see if they could find anything. And they couldn't find anything. There was nothing coming up on the metal detectors. Then a friend of mine who had won a military cross in Herrick 9, I believe, stepped on an IED. And it was a big one, because it took all four limbs off the guy who stepped on it, and he bled to death there, in the desert. The next guy lost, he was horrifically injured. I can't remember specifically what his injury was. They tell me it had to do with his head, but he also died there. The interpreter, who thought the body armor was too heavy, replaced his Kevlar with cardboard because he thought that it would be lighter, and, you know, he took a phenomenal amount of shrapnel to his stomach, and he later died of something called sepsis. It's not a very pleasant way to die. Particularly painful. Another guy was blown into a wall. And he actually came out completely unscarred because the wall collapsed on him and saved him from all the shrapnel and the blast. So he kind of apparently came up out of the dust and just kind of shook it off and was like, oof. I woke up 2 weeks later in Birmingham Hospital. Oh, they don't train you for that one. They train you for just about everything. When you wake up from a medically induced coma, the last thing that you remember is being on the ground. And not on the ground as in staring up at the dust whirling above your head. I mean, standing upright. You know, you were on patrol. So as you come out of this and you realize that you're completely immobile, you can't move and you can't do anything. You can't move, and you're in a clean environment, and you're in a foreign environment, because what you're used to is having dust in every single orifice of your body, and suddenly you're not. And, you know, you've got metal sticking out of you. I had an X-Fix on at the time. And so what happens is you do something called ICU or CCU psychosis. For soldiers, that means we believe that we've been captured by the enemy. And so we go through a period of adjustment, of very violent adjustment, where I chinned a nurse and put another one in a headlock and tried to fight my way out of the ICU, which they'd seen before. They weren't that surprised about. I then tried to negotiate my way out of it. They don't train you for that for that eventuality. So it's always tough on the families. It's always tough on everybody. But eventually you come around. And once you're fully awake, it is what it is. I can remember drifting in and out of consciousness as I was waking up in ICU and my father leaning over me and saying a couple things. You know, so-and-so is dead, so-and-so is dead, you have survived, they're taking one leg didn't, you know, one leg was blown clean off me, right? My right leg was blown clean off me in Afghanistan, you know, at the point of injury. I didn't have a foot when I got back to Bastion. They said they were trying to save the other one, and that I'm going to be okay, everything's going to be okay, just relax. There are other people in the hospital that you will recognize. So-and-so is down the hall and so-and-so is across the hall. And it didn't really settle in until an old warrant officer from Herrick 5 that I served with, a man who I love very much and my family loves very much, who came to visit me. And he said he was sorry about the loss of my two friends. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, he kind of looked at everybody and went, okay, if I'm going to be the one to do this, then I'll do it. And so he told me outright, while I was conscious and awake, no drugs in it, straight down the line, he said, this person didn't survive. You should be aware of that. And so he held me and I cried. And I cried and I cried and I mourned the death. Because up until that point, I'd been dreaming about them. And in the dreams I was having about them, there was a tremendous amount of guilt for something that I had done. I couldn't figure out what I'd done, but I'd done something, and as a result, I was feeling guilty, and then it kind of made sense, right? Like, I was the medic on the ground, and I couldn't get to them because I was injured, so that was manifesting in my mind, subconsciously. So he did that for me, and it's an ugly job, and I love him for having to do that, and I love him to this day for that. But it's a horrible, horrible sensation because there's so many different levels of grief that you go through when your friends die. And it wasn't until later somebody had said to me, you are aware that you were yelling out orders to people, to medical orders, to try and help guys on the ground who were injured. I said, no, I don't have any memory of that. The only thing I remember is looking up at one guy and saying, is my leg gone? He said, yeah. And I said, well, there goes my tap dancing days. Like, that's all I remember from that situation. That and getting on the back of a American helicopter, Black Hawk, and you know, just ripping the Americans for being American. But I think I had a lot of morphine in me by that point in time. But, you know, I don't remember trying to yell out anything to help the guys out. I remember asking my dad later when I went to Headley Court, I remember saying, you know, one of my biggest concerns, kind of like when you black out drunk, you don't mind acting like an idiot when you can remember it, because then you can apologize for it. And, you know, at least you know you're you, even if it's the worst part of you. But if you have no memory of yourself behaving, then it's an unknown factor. I mean, I realized this later, but all I ever wanted to do was to try and be that guy. You know, try and be that guy. And if that all failed as soon as my memory stopped recording things. So I had to ask my dad when I was at Headley Court. I called him up one day and said, look, I'm really struggling with something. He was like, what is it, buddy? And I was like, well, you know, when, in the parts that I don't remember, did I deal with this honorably? Like, have I behaved like a Royal Marine Commando, or have I behaved like a little boy who's tripped over and scraped his knee? 99.99% need not apply. Did I behave like that? I hope I did. I hope I did. It'll always be an unknown. It'll always be an unknown. But the guys said that I tried to yell out medical orders to try and help the dying guys. That means a lot to me. You know, my dad says that I handled it better than anybody he ever possibly knew anybody could, which helps. So those kinds of comments lead me to believe that I did, but I think it's best that I don't know. And I always question, because I think that allows me to have a degree of humility. Your main goal after being injured is to try and get things back normal as quickly as possible. A, to prove to yourself that you can you know, you can exist in normality again, but also because you have a phenomenal number of people who are trying to support you but are living in this kind of shroud of doubt that nothing will ever be the same again, and you have to let them believe that your fighting will that took you through basic training, that took you to war twice, that took you to courses, that took you around the globe wearing a Green Beret and Royal Marine Commando, you know, flashes on your sleeves, that fighting person, that fighting will, that warrior, that Viking that you are, still applies when you're on the bones of your backside. Headley Court is, I call it the a family reunion at the House of Broken Dreams. Because nobody goes into a recruiting office saying, yes, where I'd like to end my career in the military is Headley Court. If I could please end up at Headley Court at the end of it all, I'd really appreciate it. Nobody ever does that. Some of the guys I got blown up with or got blown up very close to my explosion date or, you know, before or after where I was in hospital with. You know, these guys were in and out of hospital, in and out of Headley Court around the same time. So it's a family reunion. I'm seeing the men that I love that I've just gone through this horrible, horrible time with. I was frightened to go to Headley Court. I was frightened to go there. Like, I was on antipsychotics, anti-neuros, anti-inflammatories, painkillers. Like, I was on drugs to help me take more drugs. Like I was taking, you know, 13 pills four times a day. Like, I was on so many pharmaceuticals. You know, it was unbelievable. And you throw that into the mix, and it's just a fog. And eventually everybody has to have a hook that comes down into that fog and pulls you up and out of it. Now, for a lot of guys, it's sports. Sports is a big rehabilitation thing. Sports is a big, big player in their life. Challenges, you know, rowing the Atlantic, going to the North Pole, climbing Kilimanjaro, you know, Invictus Games. These are the things that guys latch onto. I was never an athlete. So I wasn't sure what was going to be my hook. I could see other guys getting passionate about things, and I wasn't getting passionate about things. I've danced. I've acted. I mean, it makes sense that that's the direction that I should go. I didn't realize that that was a direction I could go. And when it was presented to me, I stopped and I kind of went, oh, well, this is kind of obvious, really. This is exactly where I should be going. Get back on stage. It's what you were before you joined the Royal Marines. Why not? I mean, maybe I need some of the old-time juice to kind of kickstart me back up again. The biggest problem I had was my brain. I'd had a mild traumatic brain injury as part of my injuries. And I was on, still at that time, a phenomenal amount of pharmaceuticals. Phenomenal amount. And I can remember spending hours and hours and hours trying to remember the script. When you're on a lot of those kinds of drugs, heavy-duty drugs, it's tough to memorize anything, like a daily routine, let alone a monologue.
Forces Radio.
BFBS.
Cassidy Little. Coming home.
Strictly. The people Strictly come dancing. The people Strictly, I think, is what we have to call it. And so my old boss nominated me, and he was injured the day after I was, while looking for the guys who blew us up. He got blown up himself. He was very, very badly injured. He made up some Chad cheesy line about how, had it not been for my positivity and my sense of humor during recovery and rehab, that he would have struggled to have made it through himself. Which I take with a pinch of salt, because we all supported each other in that environment. I guess the people at BBC thought that that might be an inspirational story. So I was chosen among the tens of thousands of people who were nominated by their friends to be a part of the people Strictly. I was paired with a woman named Natalie Lowe, who's about a 6'4", 6'8" in heels, blonde Australian dancer, who is lovely and very patient and very kind and very professional. I was really apprehensive about it at first. I'm not totally sure I believed that I could dance again. In fact, the idea of dancing again hadn't really dawned on me. I wasn't anticipating having to do that, but I just kind of assumed I wouldn't be dancing again because I had one leg. Yeah, whatever, I'd go to a wedding or something and everybody can have a cry when myself and my wife dance on the dance floor. Yeah, great, cheers. But proper dancing, nah. Yeah, I just didn't think that was going to be happening again. I felt a little bit like I was being set up to fail. I don't want people to feel sorry for me because I have one leg and then say, well, he did a good job, but he did have only one leg, so we couldn't expect him to win. I wanted an environment where I could fight to win, not an environment where right out the gate, I was at a disadvantage. I'll be honest, it started exactly how I thought it was going to. It started with stuff that I thought was difficult, and I couldn't get any rhythm, and I didn't have any balance, and I felt sorry for Nat because she got lumped with the disabled guy, and I couldn't move the way I wanted to move. I couldn't mimic what I thought I wanted to mimic. I couldn't get the rhythm. I couldn't get the count. I couldn't get any of it. And it was really frustrating, really frustrating. And then, of course, in between all these things, they had these weird little spa retreats and filming sessions where they surprised you with stuff. And all I wanted to do was say, would you just, look, you've given me a task. Just let me get on with it and try and figure out how I'm going to not make a total idiot of myself. You know, how I'm not going to be a total idiot. But I had to play along with it. In fact, one point in time, the producer called me up and said, hey, I need you to lighten up a bit. I was like, what do you mean lighten up a bit? You're the one who's asked a one-legged guy to get in front of the nation and try and dance. What? You telling me to lighten up? Really? One of the benefits of having no leg is that you can put different legs on there. So I put on my running leg, a leg that I'd kind of thrown in the back of the closet and forgotten about because I hate running. So I put that on. And the first session Natalie and I did on that leg, everything changed. Everything. Even her attitude towards me. She suddenly saw that she had a diamond in the rough here. But I said to Natalie before we went out, I said, look, I know that my wife is out there. And I know that your other half is out there. And they're both going to hear the watch. My parents are out there, you know. But I need you to be mine for a minute and 30 seconds. I need you to just be mine and me be yours. And we just be with each other on that floor. Just us. That doesn't mean that we ignore the audience, because it's important to include the audience in what you do, always. Even if you're not breaking the fourth wall, you include them, because that's what performance is. But you need to be 100% invested in me, and I'm 100% invested in you. And then we can go back to the joy of whatever lives we have elsewhere. But our affair, our mind, the affair of our mind and our performance and our intimacy that is required for a dance like a paso, it needs to exist. And you need to be mine. And the way the dance started was there was a spotlight on me and I walked to the center of the stage. And I kind of chewed on the cape before setting it out properly and doing some cape before the music started. And for one very long minute, it wasn't a minute, for one very long moment, for one very long second, I stood there in front of 10 million people with no music, staring straight down the lens, and just thought, right, I got you. I got you. Let's do this. I dance with my daughter. I do a little jig with her. She gets upset with me if we don't have a little dance before she goes to bed. So I dance. I dance with her, and I would love to start doing some dancing with my wife because I love to dance with my wife. She used to teach ballet, and she moves so much better than I do. Which is actually a bit of a problem because she likes to lead, bless her. And sometimes I'll let her. I am disabled. I'm proudly disabled. I was disabled while fighting for the United Kingdom. I came back disabled when some people didn't come back at all. You know, I'm a young man who had an option, really. I could have just stopped and given up, or kept going and working with what I've got. Now, I know that kind of makes me sound a bit like a we must always be pushing forward kind of cliche, but I needed to prove to my family, to my wife, to my mom and my dad and my step-parents, I needed to prove to them that their boy was okay. And so, yeah, I'm disabled. I'm proud to be disabled, and I have a blue badge, and yes, I park in blue badge spaces. You know, and when I'm not using my leg, I crawl on my hands and knees. And when I, in the middle of the night, if my daughter cries, I get out of bed and I crawl to her room and I sit there. And if she needs to be held, I get her out of that crib and I sit on the floor and I hold her. And that doesn't change. I would walk to her room. I would crawl to her room. I would use my eyelids, if that's all I had, to get to her room to hold her if she needed to be held. So I think in one sense, yes, I'm definitely disabled. But in the other sense, I don't believe that that needs to stop me from being abled. Like the other day, a couple weeks ago, my local Tesco's, this exact thing happened. I pulled in there and I watched, and you know, he was 50 years old. And he and his wife were walking by and he just stared me down as he walked by and shaking his head at me. And so I got my daughter out of the car and I followed him into Tesco's and I tapped him on the shoulder and I said, "Hey, look, I saw you looking and I wanted you to know I have one leg. I left it behind in Afghanistan and I'm legally allowed to park in a blue badge zone." He went, and I said, "Look, you don't need to respond to me. You don't need to, you know, I'm not here to fight you or threaten you or anything like that. But just be aware that I'm there legitimately and I don't want you to have to worry about it. Okay?" And he kind of went, and kind of puttered on. You know, his wife kind of stopped and looked at me and went, you know, like, awkward, and then kept walking. But, like, I don't need to be aggressive with people. I don't want to get out and start doing fisticuffs with people because I'm disabled, damn it. But the truth is, I'm missing a leg. There's got to be some perk to this crap. If it makes people feel better to call people heroes, then I don't mind the word being thrown around. I will say it in jest. Yeah, like if I say, you know, "Laura, can you get me a cup of coffee?" And she says, "No, get up off your ass and get it yourself." I'll say, "I'm a war hero." You know? But I would never, ever call myself a hero in, you know, for serious, for real. I'm here to tell you a story. I'm here to tell you a story about me. And I'm here to tell you what I've learned. If you come away thinking that I'm a hero for what I've done, well, that's your interpretation of what I've done. But you will never hear me say in front of a large group of people, in front of anybody, that I'm a hero. I don't believe that I'm a hero. I'm no hero. I'm a Royal Marine. I think in the early days, there must have been a part of me that wished that he hadn't come home. But certainly not now. Certainly not now. I mean, I have, since being in Afghanistan, got up on the West End. You know, I talked to superstars. I went onto the People Strictly Come Dancing and managed to win that with one leg. And above all of that, I married my best friend, and I now have a 2.5-year-old daughter who is changing the world, even now. And you guys don't even know it. She's incredible. To wish that I didn't come back from Afghanistan would wish all that away. You know? So no, I don't anymore. Early days, sure, but not anymore.
You've been listening to Coming Home with Cassidy Little, as told to me, William Warren. The programme is a Forces Network production. Executive produced by Nathan Tyler and Mario Chrysostomou.
On digital radio, FM and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air around the world.
This is the Forces Station.
BFBS.